Welcome to CounselorAudioSource.net. Counselor Audio Source is a weekly podcast dedicated to the professional enhancement of practicing counselors, supervisors, and counselor educators. Look for us on the web at CounselorAudioSource.net. I'm Dr. Marty Gentius at Kent State University, and this week on Counselor Audio Source, Dr. Chris Favor of John Carroll University speaks with contributing editor Laura Bruneau about using clinical hypnosis as a therapeutic tool for mental health issues.
All right, welcome to Counselor Audio Source. My name is Laura Bruneau, and I will be interviewing Dr. Chris Favor on using clinical hypnosis with clients. And so welcome, Dr. Favor. Glad to have you here.
Thank you.
I guess the first thing I wanted to ask is, what exactly is hypnosis?
Good question. And being pondered by many of the experts because there is no one accepted definition of hypnosis and what it is. To me, if you will, it's concentration, an intense concentration. Maybe you could call it super concentration. But let me give you a few definitions that I like. One is kind of an earthy one. It's simply concentrated and directed daydreaming. We've all daydreamt. And it's the idea that in the case of hypnosis, that somebody is directing this particular daydream and that someone is the hypnotherapist. Another definition I like, Laura, is selective attention to one thing and selective inattention to everything else. Therefore, by that definition, if you're paying full attention, in this case to the hypnotic experience, to the exclusion of everything else, you are, by this definition, in the trance state. Of course, by that definition, if you pay full attention to a lecture or a movie or a piece of music or a book, you're also in trance. So, to me, that lends itself to the idea that hypnosis is a fairly natural state that we kind of fall in and out of from time to time and with some frequency. Mm-hmm. So those would be two definitions that I like. The third one would be expectancy and acceptance, and that's from a fellow named Dr. Dan Zelling, actually from Akron, who says if one expects to move into trance and accepts this, that one does move into a state of hypnosis.
Hmm. Wow, that's interesting. Is there one of those definitions that you particularly subscribe to, or?
I like them all, but I especially like the a little more technical idea of selective attention to one thing, and then the selective, you know, you choose to be inattentive to other things. So there is, by that definition, there is a conscious choice to actually move into this state of concentration.
Okay. Well, maybe you could tell me a little bit about how hypnosis works.
Sure. Well, not everybody agrees on this, but it works in the sense that if you look at cognitive psychology, the cognitive psychologists say that what we pay attention to, we tend to learn better, don't we? That memory is a function of attention, if you will. So to me, hypnosis works in the sense that if you're paying full attention to the exclusion of everything else, by our earlier definition, that you're going to be better able to focus on the material at hand to be learned, or to be, in the case of hypnosis, the suggestions at hand to alter subsequent behavior.
Could you give me an example of maybe a way that hypnosis might be used in the clinical in the mental health field?
Oh, sure. Well, most of the general public thinks, in fact, a lot of the students I teach think, that the main use of hypnosis is for weight loss or smoking cessation. Mm-hmm. And there is some sense to that. I mean, hypnosis has been used somewhat successfully in weight reduction and in cessation of smoking. But there are other uses that I think are very intriguing too, such as performance enhancement in the sports arena and artistic arena, which operates on four different four different areas. If you want to go into them, we can go into them later. Another area would be to work on ego strengthening, and that is helping a person, if you will, be better able to cope with situations affecting her or him. Mm-hmm. Through some suggestions to develop ego strength. Another one would be to work on depression. One understanding, not the only one, but one understanding of depression is that it's internalized anger. So some people in this field look to get at those situations which have provoked anger in the client or the patient and to get them out, you know, better out than in kind of thing, for a catharsis to work on that person's anger. Certainly in the mental health field, there's the idea that one can work on one's anxiety and stress through hypnosis. One does not need to be, to me, interestingly enough, relaxed to go into trance, but relaxation is a product of trance. So if one produces relaxation, then one's stress and anxiety would be reduced. Another area in the mental health arena where hypnosis is used would be eating disorders themselves, such as anorexia nervosa, which is viewed in the hypnotic field as a body image disorder, and where the person's image needs some correction. Another area would be in the area of trauma, psychological trauma, where the technique of hypnosis in this case would be age regression, to age regress the person back to the traumatic incident and have them relive it to discharge the energy, to produce a catharsis, if you will, to the material. And let's see, what else in the mental health area? Certainly in terms of school situations, test anxiety reduction, you know, some specific areas where it could be used in the educational field. So anxiety, depression, performance areas, it has been used too in to work with in the sexual therapy field too, since the sex act is viewed as a performance, to work in that same kind of domain. So it has a lot of uses other than simply helping somebody lose some weight or stopping smoking.
It really sounds as if clinical hypnosis can be used with almost, I mean, you listed off so many different mental mm-hmm. health issues right there. Are there any times when it shouldn't be used?
Well, there are some what they call contraindications, times when it shouldn't be used. And let me list a few of those. One would be in our field, the if you will, the theorists who are pioneers in the field, such as a guy named William Kroger, a psychiatrist, said in his book, Clinical and Experimental Hypnosis, which I would advise people interested in this field to purchase or to somehow secure, that he said that hypnosis is, and I quote from Kroger, the opposite side of the coin of psychosis. So he wouldn't have agreed with using hypnosis with people who were actively psychotic or who were premorbidly psychotic. In fact, there's most theorists in the field would say you couldn't even work with somebody who's actively psychotic because they couldn't pay attention. You know, we go back to our definition of selective attention. But Kroger would not have encouraged people to use hypnosis with people who are premorbidly psychotic. Some of the newer theorists say that it can be, however, but that is one, if you will, area where there is some ambivalence as to whether it should be used or not. Another area would be if hypnosis would violate the person's belief system. For instance, there are some religious faith systems where hypnosis is not viewed in a positive light, so obviously it wouldn't make sense to employ it where it's going to violate somebody's beliefs. Another area for me would be that I wouldn't personally go to somebody who isn't trained in psychotherapy for hypnosis, because there are so many psychotherapeutic components to hypnosis, including the possibility of what Freudians call an abreaction, which would be kind of a flashback to a traumatic situation, and of course a therapist hopefully would be trained to handle that. So there are certainly some times when hypnosis wouldn't make sense to use. Another one I can think of, too, would be in the pain management field. We haven't really talked about that because it's not usually in the domain of the psychotherapist. But in the pain management field, I don't believe hypnosis should be used to alleviate or relieve any kind of physical kinds of pain until a physician gives approval for that because of the possibility. I mean, pain serves a purpose. It says something's wrong, so you don't want to alleviate pain until you know the cause and have permission from a physician to do so. Okay. So those are some of the times when I'd say one would want to be concerned about whether he or she should use it.
Okay. So right now, so far we've talked about some definitions of hypnosis, a little bit about how hypnosis mm-hmm. works, and then some idea of what hypnosis can be used for
yes.
and some possibilities of what it shouldn't be used for or
yes.
what it might not be as helpful for. And you mentioned briefly that there a lot of times your students think that hypnosis is purely just for smoking cessation or for weight loss, and that kind of gives me an idea that that might be a myth. A misconception about hypnosis, that it is only used for those things, that's actually not true. Are there other myths about hypnosis that a lot of people subscribe to?
Well, there's certainly the biggest myth, if you will, is that what most clients worry about, and that is I will be made to do something I don't want to do or say something I don't want to say, or I'll look like a fool, or I will be stuck in it and I'll never come out of trance, or I can't get into trance, or it's a what we might term a control issue, that things will get out of hand, or I have to be, when I'm in trance, I will be in such a state that I'm in a coma. And of course, none of these things is really true and accurate. People who are in trance are generally alert. And most people in our field would agree that you can't be made to do anything against your will, your morals, or your ethics. So that I would say that's the biggest area.
So that would be a client's fear as to what might happen.
Client's fear as to what might happen, yes.
In terms of the students, though, that you've taught.
And the students, too.
The students come in with that idea.
They come in with that idea, and because in the classes, of course, they're going to be subjects. They're going to be clients, if you will, and that's their biggest fear as students.
So there's a bit of almost uncertainty of what hypnosis is.
That's right.
Okay. And I would agree that I have a certain amount of uncertainty mm-hmm. and not exactly sure, having never seen it actually done.
Yeah.
So I think if you don't know what it looks like, it's easy sometimes to have some misconceptions.
Absolutely, especially when the media portrays it mm-hmm. in such a manner.
Do you feel that the media portrays it in a unfair light? Or?
Oh, sure. Most of what I've seen on television gives it kind of a bad name, if you will, or is just not true about it.
Okay.
I might point out, though, Laura, that you've been in trance many times, I would expect. Of course, I gave you the examples of, paying full attention to a book or a piece of music or whatever, and by that definition, you'd be in trance. But just a couple other examples would be, I would imagine at some point you had to get up at an unusual hour and you woke up a couple of minutes before your alarm clock went off. Well, the understanding is just before we wake up, and actually before we go to sleep, we go through light states of trance. So before you went to sleep, you said, gee, I have to get up at 5 in the morning or whatever, and that became the post-hypnotic suggestion to awaken you. Or there's the old highway hypnosis, if you will, that people have had a long day's work or they've been in class all day and they hop in their car and they pull out of a parking lot and 20 minutes later they're home and they didn't have to think about how they got home. So that there are natural hypnotic phenomena, if you will.
Those might be time when you, for example, with driving, I know many times I've driven and then a few minutes later I thought, oh gosh, I wasn't really even paying attention, but yet I was able to to still operate and still function mm-hmm. and all of that. And so that would be an example of a time that you could have been in a
kind of highway hypnosis.
Mm-hmm. That happens quite often, actually. Okay. Well, you mentioned something about a post-hypnotic suggestion, I believe mm-hmm. that was the phrase. And I know that in terms of the little bit I have looked at, that there's induction techniques and suggestions.
Yes.
Could you briefly provide an overview of what the hypnotic process is like?
Sure. It has a few steps to it, if you will. And what I'm talking about would be the traditional approach to clinical hypnosis. There's another approach that's not quite so traditional, and that's called Ericksonian, not from fellow who we usually think of as Erickson, Eric Erickson, but actually Milton Erickson, spelled differently, E-R-I-C-K-S-O-N, who had a different kind of set of ideas about what hypnosis was. But in traditional hypnosis, there is what we term a pre-induction talk, and that would be a time where the clinician sits down with a client and educates the client as to what hypnosis is and also what it isn't. You know, that it isn't mind control, it isn't magic, it is more concentration, it does take work on the part of the client. They're not going to get stuck in it, they're not going to be invited to do things they don't want to do or anything against their will, their morals or ethics and so on. So you have this pre-induction talk, which is educational. And then there's the induction, which is the way to get the person to focus on the issue at hand. And then a third step in the process is usually called the deepening, and that's where the clinician works with the client to help them move further into the trance state so that they're better able to concentrate on the work they want to do. So we have initially the pre-induction talk, then the induction, then the deepening, and then you have the therapeutic work itself done in trance. And then the next step would be the suggestions, the post-hypnotic suggestions, which might be something like, and of course you'll be able to become more and more relaxed with every day, or you'll be able to be less depressed every day, or you'll be able to do whatever it is outside of the trance situation.
Those would be suggestions?
Those are post-hypnotic suggestions. Or every time, if you look at the cigarette thing, every time you see a cigarette, give a negative, you know, that it will make you feel ill or something like that, that these are post-hypnotic suggestions. And then the final step in the process would be the de-induction, it's called, where the person becomes alert and is back in the waking state fully.
So what type of training did you have to go through in order to do hypnosis? What type of training would one expect that they would need to come?
Sure. In our field, so in the field of either counseling or psychology or social work, medicine, in the mental health field, there are certainly many legitimate outlets for training for hypnosis. The American Society of Clinical Hypnosis and the Erickson Foundation in Phoenix offer some superb introductory training programs for clinicians in the mental health field, and they do require a person to be a graduate in a mental health program or a graduate of such a program and also be licensed generally. And these institutes, if you will, offer weekend courses that offer continuing education credit. And then they also offer generally intensive training coursework too. The Erickson Institute, for example, offers three intensive training programs that one can attend.
So I'm curious, what happened to get you interested in hypnosis? Because I know you've been doing this for a very long time.
Yeah, for quite a while. Well, I had a colleague who told me, you really should consider some training in this. And an old friend who became subsequently an anesthesiologist who said the same thing. So in the early 1980s, at their behest, I took a workshop from the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis and got quite intrigued with it. Up till then, I was pretty much a skeptic. And simple technique. I've also learned, as I mentioned earlier, it is not magic. You know, you can't perform miracles with people. One tool in the therapeutic tools. It's useful sometimes, but not all the time with people. If it were useful all the time, there'd be no need for any other technique. Mm-hmm. So you have to put it in perspective, too.
Okay. So I know that we talked earlier about what I would call maybe some ethical concerns in terms of who might hypnosis be best used for in terms of the certain amount of certification and training. But are there other ethical concerns that we haven't talked about in terms of hypnosis that you can think of?
Well, again, I would say that one would always want to follow the codes of ethics of the professional association. In the case of counseling, of course, the ACA's ethical code, where one does not practice outside one's area of competency, that one maintains clear boundaries, as with all forms of psychotherapy, and that one does not hold oneself out to the public for doing a particular approach without training and experience in that particular approach.
And then are there any cultural issues? Are there any certain cultural groups that hypnosis might be viewed very favorably or unfavorably? I know you mentioned earlier that there might be, in terms of somebody's belief system, perhaps.
Yeah. Again, one would want to be aware of the person's culture, of their beliefs, their religious system, and so on. Also, hypnosis is generally a Western approach, if you will. Since we Westerners are generally trained out of right brain thinking, you know, it's a way to access right brain if you want to get at that. And it's very much akin, as I understand it, to, in fact, let's put it this way, that the EEG patterns of people in trance or in meditation or actually in biofeedback or in yoga are very similar. So that tells me that we have a similar phenomenon going on. It's just, how do we approach it? So there could be cultural considerations to that, too, I think.
Okay. And one thing that I had thought of when you were listing all the different types of disorders that hypnosis might be beneficial for, and you had mentioned people who are actively psychotic, that they might not be able to concentrate.
Yes.
What about somebody who has attention deficit hyperactivity disorder? Would that
good
be
question.
Would that be someone who would be a good candidate?
Actually, it's not my particular area, but my understanding is that people who are ADHD can be hypnotized because in the let's put it this way, that their attention can be moved about until they fall into a trance-like state. But there are some other groups that are not hypnotizable, if you're getting at that too. Well, as you mentioned, somebody who's actively psychotic can't pay attention, but somebody who is severely retarded also cannot pay attention to what's going on. And then also, if you will, there are people who analyze the situation who are, quote, control freaks, who have difficulty being hypnotized because they're so objective about the situation, they can't experience it subjectively. Of course, that was me, frankly, when I started doing the early training. I was concerned with what is this and do I want to allow it to happen to me and so on. But there's hope for those of us who are who analyze the situation maybe a little too much.
Okay. So I'm curious, what would you say are the benefits of hypnosis? What are the reasons for why it should be done with a client or could be done?
Well, you know, I've listed its uses earlier. You know, there are a lot of areas in which hypnosis can be very effective, not with everybody, as I've said, but with some people. It's a powerful therapeutic tool that, you know, as, you know, if you put it together with other tools, can be very, very useful in helping people get better. It's not the be-all and end-all, but it's it is certainly a very useful approach.
Okay. Well, one final question then, Dr. Favor. And I guess the reason why I ask this is that I know that a lot of students might get asked by clients during their practicum or their internship or maybe their first few years in the field by a client about hypnosis.
Yes.
Maybe that counselor is the first mental health professional that they've seen and it just comes up in conversation. Or let's say a client actually wants to have hypnosis done. Maybe they read a book or heard something, you know, in a magazine or anything like that. So what could and a counselor is not necessarily familiar with it, what might be a good response to a client about where they might be able to find more information, and what maybe could a counselor tell a client about what exactly a hypnosis is? What would be a good answer?
Sure. Well, I guess you're asking two questions.
In a way,
what's the counselor going to say as to what hypnosis is, especially if the counselor doesn't know much about it? How are they going to know how to refer and so on? So that tells me the counselor, you know, as you're doing in this interview, needs to, as with any technique, find out a little information about it. So I'd say first, the counselor may want to go to the websites of the Erickson Institute in Phoenix and the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis, which, as I recall, is ASCH.net in Chicago. And they have on those websites definitions and information. And as I recall, the ASCH website may have a page on what you present to the client, too. I always thought it was helpful to give clients an information sheet to read, and if unless it was some kind of emergency, which it usually wasn't, to allow them some time to think about whether they want to have hypnosis and to study up on it so that they're participants in the process, if you will. And then as to where you go to find a clinician, again, the ASCH has on its website a directory of certified clinicians in hypnosis. And to be certified by the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis, you must have a degree, a graduate degree in mental health, either in counseling or social work or psychology or psychiatry. And actually, dentistry, too, is one of their areas, but because some dentists use hypnosis for anesthesia. But in the areas of mental health, you have to have your graduate degree. You also must be licensed at the independent level, and you must have X amount of experience and supervision to get this certification. So, and the directory is of certified professionals, has listings by state and city within the state. So that's a good place to start.
So it seems as if a counselor, if they haven't been trained or if they don't have that knowledge, that they should really let the client either check out those websites or get that information, or they can help them look up that information.
Oh, I think, yeah, sure.
And that would be a good place to start.
Absolutely. I would encourage the client to study up on what it is and so on. And the counselor to do that as well. You know, the counselor could even call the potential therapist, the hypnotherapist, to find out more before they make the referral, too.
Okay.
That could be a possibility.
Okay. Well, great. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me, Laura.
You've just heard an interview with Dr. Chris Favor of John Carroll University speaking with contributing editor Laura Bruneau about clinical hypnosis. Look for previous podcasts, show notes, and listener feedback on the podcast website at counselorAudiosource.net. Listeners can leave comments or questions for our interview guests or hosts through our Skype.com internet telephone ID, Counselor Audio Source, or by calling 330-871-4242. Counseling techniques and interventions discussed in the Counselor Audio Source broadcast are meant for use by counseling professionals, and Counselor Audio Source is not held liable for any use of the techniques mentioned in the program. Our music bed today is Memorial Day from Jamie Beauchamp. His and other PodSafe music can be found in the PodSafe Music Network at podshow.com. Counselor Audio Source is licensed under the Creative Commons, a nonprofit organization offering a flexible copyright for creative work.